The New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. This podcast brings together some of those stories. On the morning of December 7, 1941, the people of the United States woke up to the news of an attack on the naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Americans immediately answered the call of service both abroad and at home, as they have throughout history. In this episode, we talk about New Mexico's reaction and participation in World War II, and later, the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Lonnie Harper was born January 2, 1936. Lonnie describes the immediate impact the tragic event of Pearl Harbor had on not only the country, but locally in New Mexico.
Every farmer had 7 or 8 kids, and there was a lot of farmers. There was a lot of families. And what happened? World War II broke out. Now, I was 5 years old when Pearl Harbor came about, and that changed everything. My oldest brother, Jake, was already in Europe fighting the German Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich. But my number two brother was a junior, I think he was a junior in high school when it broke out. And of course, he got permission from Dad, and within a month, he had joined the Navy after Pearl Harbor. And all the boys of that age, they went. Now, there was no question. They all joined the Army, Navy, or Air Force. Well, there wasn't no Air Force in those days. It was called the Army Air Corps. But that caused a lot of a mass exodus. Plus, farming was rough. It was you made maybe one crop that you could cut the wheat, you know, and put in the granary. The rest of the time, you're just dragging a machine over the land just to get enough seed to replant the next crop. But once out of every 5 years, it's not a very good living. The war, World War II, the munitions factories, the people building war machines, everybody went to California. The whole coast, West Coast. Factory after factory after factory. Men and women, by the thousands, had immediate jobs. And that country just, boy, they headed for California. So that was the, if I could say, the one changer. Mm-hmm. World War II and Japan, Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. changed everything.
Many of our interview subjects, like Lonnie, were just kids when these events were happening. Labeo Martinez and Bronson Springstead, who were also born in the 1930s, first heard the breaking news of war over the airwaves.
The only thing I remember, they had a battery-operated radio. And I think they were very rare. Not too many people had them. And the only thing I remember about the radio when I was a young boy, young down here, Mr. Sellers here had one in the store. And I went in there with a nickel or something to buy some bubble gum, and they were listening to the news when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
I remember that
very vividly.
My granddad, Luke Kirk, had this old battery-operated radio, so we would listen to the news. It was all about the war. Batteries were not rechargeable, but they were big batteries. And this radio was about that long, about that tall, and it was real scrabbled. You'd have to really fine-tune it to get any kind of news. I don't even think Gallup had a news station at that time. But Albuquerque, we could get some from Albuquerque. And what was strange is we would get KRLD in Dallas. I don't know why.
Bronson's family, as well as many others, had to ration food, health supplies, and other items.
It was wartime. Things got pretty scarce. I mean, we were getting stamps for the government. I even found an issued green sugar stamp for me, because even the kids had to have these stamps, though, to buy sugar, to buy certain items, not canned goods, but sugar, flour, baking powder, that kind of stuff. You know, I had rheumatic fever in the first grade, and all the antibiotics were going to the war. You know, penicillin, it's a strep, so penicillin was a drug of choice, but all that was going to the war effort. So the doctors, all they would tell you is lots of fruit juice and fruits and vegetables and a lot of sunshine. Took a long time.
Jerry Saunders was born on August 28, 1935 in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Jerry talks about the difficulty of getting essential items that required ration coupons. Most kids would agree that nothing is more essential than candy.
During the war, when we lived with ration coupons, sugar and chocolate were two things it was hard to get. I can remember looking in the window at one of the little cafes on Main Street, this is Estancia, at the display of a few Hershey bars that they had obtained somehow. We were not allowed to have them because they took too many coupons. But oh, how we craved them when we couldn't have them. And chewing gum was the same way. There were times you wanted to kill for a stick of Juicy Fruit. You also needed coupons for shoes, gas, and other items that were considered vital to the war effort.
Jerry mentions that her dad was called to serve.
And then he was called up to active duty, because that would have been 40... I don't know whether it was 41 or 42. I could probably figure that out, but it would take a little digging. And he, because he had been in ROTC, and he was a lieutenant or something, and we went to Fort Sill in Oklahoma. He went first, and then because of gas rationing, my mom and another wife, whose husband was also in the same group with my dad, they pooled their gas ration tickets and filled in the back of a big old Chevy four-door car, filled in the back of the seat up to the same level as the seat, made beds there, and they drove themselves and their kids to Fort Sill to join the dads there.
Gasoline as well as tires were needed for the war effort, as described in this next clip by Mary Ellen Warren. She was born on the Sierra Grande Ranch near Des Moines, New Mexico in 1927. She says her dad would not allow her to drive in order to protect their vehicle's tires.
My daddy wouldn't let me drive because we lived in the country and there were a lot of rocks. He knew I'd hit a rock and ruin a tire, and tires you couldn't buy back during the war because you had to, you know, you were limited to how much, just like gasoline was rationed. Mm-hmm. You had these stamp books and you could buy so much gasoline. And he knew if I hit, I'd ruin the tire. So he didn't let me learn to drive.
For Mary Ellen, World War II was something she experienced very close to home. She recalls a time military planes in distress flew over the family ranch.
An airplane crashed on our ranch and set the prairie on fire, and it was a soldier in the plane. He was killed on impact. And when that happened, I guess there was another plane with him, and he circled the house until my mother was home alone with Grandpa and my little brother, and the airplane circled the house until he got their attention, and then she saw the fire. So she loaded up my grandpa and my little brother in the wagon. She had to catch the horses, harness them up, and then she got the cream cans full of water and the gunny sacks, and then went to where the fire was, worked to put it out. My older brother had just come home from the war.
She refers to her brother William E. Warren. He was MIA in Germany, and one day they got a letter from him saying he was in a POW camp.
That was in the summer of 45, and he had just come back from, and he couldn't help us because he was so crippled up from having his feet frozen in Germany. And he was a POW.
In contrast, there was a German POW camp just outside of Artesia, and the conditions there were drastically different, as described by Lucille Roland Wolf. Lucille was born in Artesia in 1925.
During World War II, they had a prisoner of war camp at Hageman, which was outside of Artesia, not far. They trucked those prisoners in open trucks that had the big sides on them, you know, to the different fields where the farmers needed help. Because, of course, during the war, they didn't have any help. So the prisoners were put to work. The prisoners said they lived better than they did in Germany because they had little refrigerators and radios and the prisoners' quarters. And they got fed. When they'd be working and picking the cotton and harvesting the crops down, sometimes stop there at the store and they'd get cold drinks for all of the prisoners that had been working out in the field. And they'd stop at the store and they'd get cold drinks for all the prisoners because they had to drive out to Artesia, past Artesia, to Hegeman.
As the war efforts continued, programs like the Civilian Conservation Corps, or the CCC, would help young men find work and also get them ready to serve in the Army. Kay Bird was born on April 7, 1928, in Savannah, Georgia. Her family would later move to Elephant Butte, New Mexico. Kay talks about a CCC camp that was located in Elephant Butte.
You know, those CCC camps were just wonderful, what they did. They took mostly boys from the East who had hardly ever been out, even outside. You know, they lived in tenements and places, and they put them to work. They did a lot of work up at Elephant Butte Dam and all kinds of work, and they became strong and healthy. They were a sickly, frail bunch when they got there, and it's a good thing they did, because the next thing they had to do was fight a war.
Larry Gordon was born in 1926 in Oklahoma and moved to New Mexico in 1930. He met his wife while attending the University of New Mexico. He served in the Navy in the 40s, and his wife served in the Marine Corps, as he proudly recalls.
She went away and became an officer in the Marine Corps, and she wasn't gone very long for that. She was one of those so-called 90-day wonders. And about a year after she returned, we married.
Was that unusual at that time for a woman to go into the military?
Yeah.
Okay.
She was in the first Marine women's class following following World War II, which it was.
But it was the first one ever.
It was the first one.
Wow.
And there was about 60-some started in it, and only about, as I recall, 16 maybe completed the rather rigorous requirements.
Claude Leyendecker attended college at New Mexico A&M, or present-day New Mexico State University, in the early stages of World War II.
I started at New Mexico A&M in the summer of 1942. It was the summer semester, I remember, and that was when World War II was beginning various phases. College had an ROTC program. It took two, 3, or 4 years to make it through their program, and the war was now. A bunch of farm boys and ranch boys that I knew joined the active services that were facing the enemy at that time. I wasn't doing too good in college, that's for sure. So I joined what was called then the Air Corps. Made it sound a little stronger and a little larger. They changed the name of the United States Air Force.
Monty Shriver was born in El Dorado on September 28, 1934, and his family moved to Aztec in 1937. While there, they had blackout drills to simulate a possible attack from Japan.
But I know we had blackouts. They would practice a blackout in Aztec.
Okay.
And you could hear the plane might fly over, and you know, but the lights, of course, all our lights are out. That's a big thing, to have blackouts.
Okay.
Just a blackout.
He later joined the ROTC program while in college. This was during a new conflict, the Korean War, which lasted between 1950 and 1953.
ROTC, since we're a land-grant university, it used to be, because of the Morrill Act, it was required for the first 2 years to be in ROTC. Now, of course, the Korean War was on, and you got a deferment. So we all wanted to be in the first 2 years. I mean, you knew you'd be deferred. And then the last 2 years, I was in Air Force, ROTC. You wanted to get into advance, because then you, at that time, everyone was getting drafted. We said, well, if we're going to serve, we might as well go in as officers.
Immediately following the Korean War, the Vietnam War also broke out. The United States got involved in the conflict in the mid-60s. David Duran, who was born in the Embulo-Dixon area, describes the draft of 1969.
They drafted so many people in August of 1969, because the draft was going to end, they were going to go to the lottery, where they'd pick ping pong balls with numbers on them and associate that with a name. There were so many people drafted that there wasn't enough room for them in Fort Bliss. They were sleeping on the floor in the halls. And there were so many kids that couldn't even speak English. A lot of Hawaiians were not literate in English that they had drafted. A lot of kids from Puerto Rico who could only speak Spanish were there with us. It was a huge draft. I imagine most boot camps in the country were full of people. The military thought that was the end of their ability to get people into the service. And then I ended up going to Fort Bragg for a year. The reason why I think there was a delay in my orders from boot camp to find out where I was going to go is because I was going to be assigned to a top secret area of the military. So when I finally got to Fort Bragg, my orders weren't even there. I mean, my paperwork wasn't there. It was delayed. They were trying to get a top secret clearance for me, which means the FBI had to go around and do a bunch of research on me, I suppose.
According to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the estimated number of veterans in the state of New Mexico as of 2017 is 158,994. That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in. This oral history project was made possible in part by a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council. Additional funding was provided by the Loomis Foundation and the Southwestern Border Cultures Institute at New Mexico State University. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this presentation do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the New Mexico Humanities Council, or New Mexico State University. The full interviews are available at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico. More information is available at the museum website at nmfarmandranchmuseum.org.